Christmas tree. How lovely are the branches.
Most of us are familiar with the classic Yuletide song, O Christmas Tree. A festive season staple since the beginning of the 20th century, at this time of year, it is sung across the English-speaking world. But did you know, as is the case with many Christmas traditions that we hold dear in Ireland and elsewhere, that it originated in Germany? O Tannenbaum, literally, O Fir Tree, began life as a German traditional folk song. The melody was composed back in the 16th century, but had to wait until 1824 to be paired with its tree-themed lyrics, which were penned by the Leipzig organist, teacher and composer Ernst Anschütz.
O Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehen.
It was never intended to be a Christmas song. The lyrics, unlike English ones that came later, don't actually make reference to Christmas at all, but rather to the tree's evergreen nature, which was meant to convey faithfulness and constancy. But over the course of the following decades, Anschütz's song gradually became associated with Christmas, no doubt prompted by the role that evergreen trees had begun to occupy during the festive season over the same period. I'm standing in the foyer of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Every year, to celebrate the festive period, they commission a designer to create a Christmas tree for the museum's grand entrance. These unique installations range from lavishly decorated real trees to handcrafted twists on the tradition. In front of me is a spectacular Christmas tree, which was designed by a young German student called Anna Hunerkopf. It was created as part of a competition for students of the University of Applied Sciences in the Bavarian city of Coburg, the birthplace of Prince Albert. Entitled Freedom, it is a contemporary reimagining of the Christmas tree, formed out of poles from which are suspended 200 ornate white origami birds, and which was gifted to the museum by Coburg City in commemoration of this year's bicentenary of the births of both Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. And what a beautiful tree it is.
I'm Catherine Jones, and I'm Senior Curator of Decorative Arts at the Royal Collection.
Although widely acknowledged for his role in popularising the tradition of the Christmas tree, Prince Albert was not the first royal to bring the Christmas tree into the palace.
Christmas tree was actually very popular in Germany originally, and the trees were brought into homes from as early as the 16th century. And the first monarch, really, to be involved with the Christmas tree was Queen Charlotte. She was the wife of King George III, and she brought a tree into the house, and at that date it was probably a yew tree. And obviously it wouldn't be the whole tree. That would have filled even a palace. It would have been rather large. So they would probably have been a large branch, and it would have been decorated, but not as we would know it now. It would probably have had wax candles and sweetmeats, so little baskets with sweets in, or gilded walnuts, things like that. And that became a tradition within the royal family, but it was purely for the royal family to see. And it's really Prince Albert that we credit with making the Christmas tree popular in this country. And of course, he brought in fir trees into the palaces. He remembered it from his own childhood, and he wanted his children to enjoy the Christmas tree in the same way. So he would bring in a fir tree. It would always be decorated only on Christmas Eve with the candles and the sweets. And then the presents would be put around it, but they wouldn't be wrapped up. They would be laid out on a table, and children were allowed in to see the tree with all the candles lit, and they could then enjoy the toys. And he writes to his stepmother about how much they were enjoying it and how they would shout with delight when they saw their toys. Albert was also keen to present trees to local institutions around Windsor. So schools and army barracks were presented with trees from the park in Windsor. And so that it became sort of a very popular idea. And of course, with Dickens popularising the sort of Victorian idea of Christmas, the idea of the Christmas tree spread across the country. And it's become absolutely traditional for every home now. And we can't really imagine Christmas without it.
Leon.
So nice to see you.
Nice, nice to see you too. How are you?
Yes, I'm well, thank you.
I'm looking at an image of Queen Victoria and Albert and their children standing round a Christmas tree. This image is from the Illustrated London News in 1848, and it served as an iconic image for the public of how the royal family celebrated Christmas and how families might emulate some of these traditions that the royal family had brought to England at this time. So around the Christmas tree, we have the family gathered, we have lights on the Christmas tree, we have little ornaments that were obviously meant to attract the attention of the children. The children are pointing at the tree as if to tell their parents, look at the exciting things there are here. And around the tree, we have these images that have been drawn in of plenty. So we have fish, we have images of other kinds of food, of turkeys, of partridges, and also there are images of charity. So there are images of giving to the poor and images of happy children. There's an image of a sleigh. And all of this was designed as a kind of image of what Christmas was, not just for the royal family, but what it could be in the imaginations and perhaps in reality for people who chose to make Christmas that central feature of their lives.
But Prince Albert can't take all the credit for the present-day popularity of the Christmas tree. That honour goes to a character almost as famous as Father Christmas himself, Charles Dickens. So much of what is considered Christmas tradition, especially in the English-speaking world, flows directly from the works of the most celebrated author of the Victorian period. Leon Litvak is Professor of Victorian Studies at Queen's University Belfast and a world-renowned expert on the life and work of Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens was somebody who took on this idea that had been already in England for a number of years and truly popularized for the public imagination what Christmas could be. Dickens has two stories that are extremely evocative on this subject of the Christmas tree. The first one is called A Christmas Tree, and we get the image of a child who was looking at the tree and imagining what all of the little ornaments on the tree are in terms of animated objects. So we have toys that move, we have little toy theatres, we have mechanical toys, we have lots of images that probably were part of Dickens's own childhood. So while he did not have a Christmas tree, because it was before the time of Prince Albert introducing it, certainly there were decorations in his home, and this was very much part of what Dickens wished to celebrate as Christmas. He saw this as a fantastic celebration and one that could excite the imagination. Also in the Christmas tree, he talks about what he can see in between the branches, and so he introduces the idea of fairy tales. He sees Little Red Riding Hood and Little Red Riding Hood going through the forest to the grandmother's house, and he introduces other kinds of fairy tales, for example, the Arabian Nights, in an effort to show how this tree is not only the focus of his imagination, but it's something in which he can go in between the branches and he can really get into how the tree serves as a function for fancy, which is what he called imagination. And this particular story is fantastic in terms of the wildness of the imagination that Dickens was able to introduce into this inanimate object, this tree, and thereby engage with the public in getting them to take on the Christmas tree as something that they could imagine about. It's particularly evocative for children, I think, then and now. So For example, children will look forward to decorating the tree. Children, both then and now, will look forward to putting their favorite ornaments on the tree. Some of these ornaments they might have made themselves at school. This was certainly the case in our own family, and we preserve the little objects that our children made at school out of paper or out of pine cones or out of other kinds of things. And it serves as an entry point into nostalgia. And I think for many people, a lot of these traditions that we associate with the Christmas tree, with other celebrations of Christmas, are to do with what they experienced as children and how they can recall those and how they can make those extremely evocative for themselves and for their families at Christmas time. The other story that is extremely interesting from the point of view of having a focus on a Christmas tree is called A Curious Dance Around a Curious Tree. Now, it actually concerns the mentally ill in Bedlam, that is Bethlehem Hospital in London, which is famous throughout history as being a place where we imagine that people who have certain kinds of mental issues were sent. Now, in times gone past, and before Dickens's time, it was a terrible place where, for example, the public would go and would see the people who were mentally ill, and they would gawp at them, and they would gaze at them, and they would see them as these interesting curiosities. By Dickens's time, a lot of the cruelties that had been inflicted on mental patients had ceased, and Dickens was entering this particular institution with a view to what can he learn from the minds and from the actions of these people. And he goes at Christmas time, and he sees a wonderful Christmas tree that is decorated, that is lit, and he sees the inmates dancing around this tree. So it's interesting how for people who are in such an institution, if they have a focus, if they have a common purpose, Dickens is interested in how they can then join together in an interesting kind of celebration. And after the dance is finished, the officials from Bedlam, they hand out the little ornaments from the tree to the individual inmates who derive presumably some pleasure from this. So Dickens in that story, while he's talking about people who have, I suppose in his estimation, a kind of childlike mental state, he uses the Christmas tree again as something on which people can focus and on which people, however their mental states are, they may remember things from their past, even though they're not able necessarily to communicate these in a rational way that we would expect, they're still able to focus on this image, on the light, on the ornaments, on perhaps some distant memory that is very deeply buried in their psyches, in order to derive some happiness and some pleasure from Christmas. So I think in both these stories, Dickens is interested in the idea of excitement, in the idea of the firing of the imagination, and in the idea of having this interesting focus that brings into play ideas of childhood, ideas of nostalgia, ideas of family, ideas of community, and perhaps even the religious ideas behind Christmas. Because while Dickens was not overtly religious, he did have religious sensibility. And we can see this, for example, in A Christmas Carol and in other narratives that he has, where he does understand the humanity of Jesus and what Jesus was able to offer humanity in terms of an example that people are encouraged to follow. From the time of Cromwell, Christmas was downplayed, and Christmas was very much figured as a kind of ordinary working day for people. And this extended into about the 18th century, when people's sentiments began to change and there was a renewed interest in music for religious worship. And for this, we have to thank the Methodists, who, as you may know, were a kind of derivative of Anglicanism. And so it's from the Methodists that we have, for example, the Wesleys' Hark the Herald Angels Sing and other kinds of carols. In this period, in the Victorian period, carols came very much to the fore. We can think of many carols that were written in this period, whether it's Once in Royal David City or others. And those carols then became part of the kind of popular culture of the time. So people began to sing carols in the streets. People went from door to door singing carols, which I do actually with my friends here in South Belfast. So those traditions still exist. Also, other traditions that came to the fore were the giving of presents, the playing of games in people's homes, for example, Blind Man's Buff. So Christmas became a much more animated and a much more actively celebrated festival in this period, and certainly having these visible objects like the Christmas tree helped to have a focus for people's minds, a focus in people's homes. It was very obvious from any home, whether from inside or outside, that there was a tree. So, for example, if the curtains were open, you could see not only the tree, but if the tree was lit in those times with candles, you could see this illuminated from both inside and outside. And it was a signal that Christmas was being celebrated. And if you look at the weather outside nowadays, where it's dull and it's dreary, to have lights, to have sparkle, to have celebration is very much what we need in the dead of winter in Ireland.
One of the most important pre-Christian winter celebrations was the ancient Nordic festival known as Yule. Today, the words Yule and Christmas are virtually synonymous for most people. But originally, they had nothing to do with each other. Yule was a centuries-old midwinter feast in honour of the Norse god Odin, generally running for 3 nights from the solstice itself, though local practices differed. Animals were sacrificed, toasts were drunk to good harvests, peace and the king, and massive fires were lit. A special piece of tree trunk was also selected and brought into homes, the Yule log, a precursor to the Christmas tree, perhaps, but certainly not as we know it today. Rather than be adorned with decorations, the log was to be kept burning in the hearth for the symbolic period of 12 days, a length of time which, like Yule itself, was co-opted by the early Christian church for its new celebration. Some believe that the tradition of bringing trees into homes in celebration of the winter solstice goes back further again, to ancient Egypt. Regardless of when the tradition started, there is no doubt that Christmas trees have really caught on. Today they appear in all shapes and sizes. At this time of year, it is almost impossible to walk down the main thoroughfare of any European city without seeing at least one. But probably the most famous, not to mention the most glamorous Christmas tree of all, is to be found in North America, the massive Christmas tree outside Rockefeller Center in New York. Every year, thousands of locals, tourists, and celebrities turn out to witness the switching on of its lights, which has become a Big Apple institution. Sunshine.
And now to a big event right here in Midtown Manhattan, the world's most famous Christmas tree has been lit up for the season. Cheered as they flip the switch on the Rockefeller Center tree earlier tonight. This year's tree is a stunning Norway spruce from Wallkill, New York. It's decorated with an LED light strand more than 5 miles long. A new star was
big enough in 2018 to be serenaded by the great Tony Bennett.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.
This year's tree is a 77-foot-tall Norway spruce, which was planted in 1959, making it 60 years old. It weighs approximately 14 ton and has been decorated with over 50,000 coloured lights. During the festive season, it is estimated that 750,000 people are expected to visit it every day.
All aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
Christmas trees have become a tradition all over the world. But why do we go to all this trouble? Why do we take trees, drag them into our homes, and cover them in baubles and lights? It's quite an odd thing to do, if you think about it, and it seems to have precious little connection to celebrating the birth of a major religious figure, aside perhaps from the star on the top. Well, some psychologists maintain that it's all about making ourselves feel good. Simply put, there is scientific evidence that Christmas trees make us happy. Perhaps it's the whole ceremony of decorating the tree together as a family and the sense of nostalgia it brings. Perhaps it's the warm glow of the lights and the twinkle of the decorations. Perhaps it's that unmistakable fresh conifer smell and having such a potent symbol of nature in the house. It's certainly not the needles all over the carpet. Not only that, studies have also shown that people who put up their Christmas trees and decorations earlier are happier than those who wait until closer to the big day. There is a huge psychological element to Christmas, and indeed to the Christmas tree, as psychoanalyst Michael Murphy explains.
Christmas is a festival of memories. When we're presented with something new, we try to get our bearings psychologically by referencing the library of memories we have inside. So when we're presented at the end of each year with a Christmas tree and Christmas lights and decorations, although the experience is familiar, it resonates with those magical memories we have of the Christmases from our childhood. And we invest the new Christmas tree with all of those feelings, the good and the bad, and we also project onto the tree our hopes and expectations, and indeed the excitement that we feel at Christmas time. The ritual of going out and choosing the best Christmas tree, bringing it home like a hunter-gatherer, and setting it up and decorating it, acts as a buffer against the anxieties from which we all suffer by making our world a more predictable place. The family gathers around the Christmas tree in a special location, which is our family home, and we share that experience with special people, our closest relatives and friends. The green colour of the Christmas tree is very important for our psychological well-being. Green has strong associations with nature, green grass, green leaves. So for us, the colour is a symbol of the renewing power of nature itself and of our place within the natural order. Green is often used in decorating for its calming effect. Guests waiting to appear on television often wait in a green room to relax. So green has the effect on us of being restful and soothing. In mythology, the colour green has long been a symbol of fertility and new beginnings. In the dead of winter, the Romans would give each other the gift of evergreen plants as a sign of good luck and good health. And the German tribes would bring evergreen trees into their homes and decorate them with fruit and nuts. In the language, we speak about green shoots appearing, so the colour green works for us as a symbol of hope.
Oh Christmas tree, forever true your colour. Oh Christmas tree, forever true your colour. Your boughs so green in summertime, stay bravely green in wintertime. Oh Christmas tree, forever true.
The evergreen Christmas tree symbolises for us the tree of life, which is the cosmic tree linking heaven and earth and connecting all forms of creation. It demonstrates the renewal and continuance of life in darkness, particularly if we've been suffering in dark times. apples and holly become available during the winter months, and in order to make things more vibrant on the tree, these red fruits were used as decorations. We use the colour gold in the decorations because it brings warmth and energy. Gold symbolises for us wealth and royalty, and gold is one of the gifts that the wise men brought to Jesus. Another colour included in the five main colours of the Christmas tree lights is blue, which we associate with cold and ice. Blue is also found in nature, the pale blue daytime sky in Ireland, or the rich dark blue of the Mediterranean Sea. Blue has the effect of calming us and making us feel serene. And finally, there's white light, which is the colour of snow in our northern hemisphere. In ancient Egypt and Rome, priestesses wore white as a symbol of purity and innocence. And today, white is the preferred colour of a bride's dress, for example. As I said at the beginning, Christmas is a festival of memories.
The holly and the ivy, when they are both full grown, of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears the crown. The holly bears a blossom as white as lily flower, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ to be our sweet Saviour.
But could any tree be a Christmas tree? Why did certain species become favoured over others when it came to marking the birth of Christ? The key criteria appear to be that it needed to be a tree that remained green during the winter months, a symbol of new life and regeneration, as well as a splash of colour to brighten dark days. And that ruled out the vast majority of deciduous trees that shed their leaves each autumn. No, only an evergreen would do, and ideally a moderately large one with abundant green foliage and branches for hanging decorations, broad at the base and tapering to a narrow, pointed top. Juvenile conifers, such as spruce and fir, were the ideal choice. When we hear the term evergreen, most of us immediately think of conifers. And the vast majority of coniferous trees are indeed evergreens. Think pines, spruces, firs, cedars, and cypresses. There are exceptions, however. The larch is an example of a conifer that is not an evergreen, shedding its needles in autumn and remaining bare throughout the whole winter. But there are also plenty of non-coniferous evergreen plants, several of which have a much longer association with Christmas festivities than spruce, pine, or fir trees do. Holly and ivy are two prime examples. Both are common native species across much of Europe, including Ireland, and both retain their vibrant green leaves throughout the whole year. Even in pre-Christian times, people would cut boughs of holly and sprigs of ivy to decorate their homes. A way to lend the room an air of springtime during the dark, drab days of winter. Holly has another advantage over most other Irish evergreens. Not only does it keep its green leaves, it fruits in winter too. These scarlet holly fruits, or berries if you prefer, have themselves become a symbol of Christmas, and may indeed be one of the main reasons why the colour red has become so strongly associated with the festive season. In Ireland, one of the best ways to see all of these Christmas plants together in one place is to take a trip to the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, Dublin. Its director, Dr. Matthew Jebb, took me on a tour of some of the key Christmas plants in the garden's collection.
Well, here we are, and welcome to the National Botanic Gardens, Derek.
Oh, thank you, Matthew.
And here is our wonderful Christmas tree.
That's not a Christmas tree. That looks like a holly
tree. But look how beautifully decorated it is.
It's huge!
Covered in lovely red berries, glossy green leaves. This was a very significant plant to our ancestors in the middle of winter. Here was something that was still alive and fresh. All the other trees had lost their leaves, and this clearly was a tree that lived forever. It was always green. So it was something very symbolic in the middle of the winter. Here was life.
But it doesn't have needles, it's not a fir tree, it's not a pine tree.
It's not a fir tree, but that was a modern invention of what Christmas turned into. But As a way of decorating our homes, the holly and the ivy, two of these incredible evergreen plants, were brought into the house to show that here we were, the middle of the winter, the shortest day of the year, but it was getting longer. Already by the 25th of December, people could perceptibly measure the days were longer, so spring was coming back. And there was always that anticipation, well, maybe the sun would get lower and lower and lower, yeah, and we would never get back to spring. So there is a certain celebration of joy that at last these short days are going to start to lengthen once more. And one of the amazing things about holly is it's covered in little spiny leaves. So as a plant that's keeping its leaves all year, we used to sort of say, well, maybe, you know, they're spiny to stop animals grazing them. But that doesn't explain why the leaves are spiny at the top of the tree. And there are a lot of theories as to why a holly is spiny. And one of them is that having little spikes on you acts like a lightning conductor. You are literally removing the static charge on the plant, so it loses less water in the winter. Because you've got to remember that, yes, it rains a lot in the winter, but it can be very, very cold. These leaves are having a problem sucking water up from the ground, because normally in the summer, the water's evaporating from the leaf, so it keeps all the leaves happy. In the winter, that's not happening. And to bring the water up is probably quite a struggle for a poor old holly tree. So trying to reduce its electrostatic charge has probably reduced the problem of losing too much water.
I'm impressed with how many berries there are on this particular specimen. Why aren't the birds eating them?
They will do. And one of the lovely things, I don't know if we'll hear them, but the missel thrushes protect these trees. So a pair of missel thrushes will carefully make sure their territory encloses a couple of trees like rowans or holly trees. And this is the larder. They will stop other birds. They'll chase other birds off from eating them. And all through the winter, they're going to make sure they have got enough food supply to see them through to spring. And not only do we have holly, but right across the way there, that tree looks as though it's got great green lumps growing in its canopy. Those are mistletoe plants growing on a lime tree. Now, mistletoe is not native to Ireland. It was probably introduced here in the Botanic Gardens in the 19th century as a way just to show people the exotic charms of plants from all over Europe and the world. But the mistletoe is extraordinary, and exactly like the holly, it comes in male and female plants. So not all of the plants will carry berries. And some people have holly trees in their garden and they're disappointed after a number of years. They say, my holly tree is never bearing berries. And that's because they've got a male plant. So you have to have the female and the male in order that you get holly berries. And exactly the same thing with the mistletoe plant. Mistletoe is a parasite. So it's put its roots actually into the branches of the tree up there. And it's relying on its water supply. But it's behaving like a tree that's 30 foot off the ground. So it's in full sunlight. And yet it's got the tree to plummet into the ground and get its water.
So is it always parasitic? Is there such a thing as a mistletoe tree?
Incredibly, there is. Now, in a related family, a Santalacea, it's a parasitic tree and it's parasitizing all the grass around it. So the tree looks as though it's doing all the work, but actually it's not. It's put all its roots stuck into the grass plants around. So it's a complete inversion of roles. This is a tree that's parasitizing the grass and it's robbing them of food and their water supply. And therefore, it's getting a huge helping hand in its own life. But these mistletoes up there, of course, are very stressed in the winter because the lime tree, again, is not sucking up a lot of water. So we see that under the lime tree through the winter, the mistletoe is constantly dropping its leaves and they're all shriveled and dried out because it's having a struggle to get water. But its berries are ripening, and even from here we can see the little white dots of the female plants. Those are the berries on the plant. And again, related to the mistle thrush we were talking about, the mistletoe and the mistle thrush both get their name from exactly the same thing, which is mistle is, of course, a German. Mist is dung in German. And so mistletoe is actually Old English, derived from Old German, and it literally means dung twig or dung branch. So the earliest people knew that the seeds were transmitted by birds from one tree to the next, and usually in their droppings.
So through the digestive system, and
exactly,
that's the other end.
Exactly.
But why do people want to kiss under mistletoe?
Well, there's a tradition that in certain cultures, the mistletoe would be hung up and you would pick one berry off it, and it gave you the right to give someone a kiss.
Oh, I see.
So, of course, there was a time when the plant would be bereft of all its berries and you were no longer allowed to kiss under the mistletoe.
Prior to that, a lot of snogging went on.
I'd say, again, very useful way of passing those long winter nights. Something like mistletoe. And it is. It's all to do with new life. So, of course, it is celebrated, this idea, Saturnalia, which is what the Romans used to call their midwinter festival, was a scene of what we would term outrageous behaviour. So there would be a great deal of snogging going on.
Interestingly, despite the long association with the winter solstice and then with Christmas, the mistletoe, unlike holly, ivy and the Christmas tree itself, was not traditionally celebrated in Christmas songs. Perhaps this was due to what some considered its overly sexualized image, its parasitic nature, or its representation of base, unchristian desires. Remarkably, the mistletoe's first mention in mainstream Christmas music appears to have come as late as 1952, with the initial release of I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, now a Yuletide favourite.
I saw Mommy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night.
And there's your first tree down today, Christy. What kind of a tree is that?
That's a beautiful Abies coreana, Korean for.
The species of conifer that are usually grown as Christmas trees originally hail from northern latitudes. And the Nordic countries in particular have long been associated with the business of Christmas tree production. Traditional Christmas tree species are also ideally suited to the Irish climate and tend to grow very well here. And there is a thriving Christmas tree farming sector in this country too, as Terry Flanagan discovered when he met Christy Kavanagh.
We're midway between Newton McKennedy and Roundwood, right on top of the hill. This field we're standing in here is the late Sives field, Sive Poppy. The soil here is particularly suitable. The trees like the high elevation. They like the wind as well that comes from the west. A lot of wind, very windy site. Yeah.
The trees, you say, they're not all the same species, because I noticed as we were climbing up here to get to where we are, different varieties.
Yeah, our main species is noble fir. We have noble fir, Nordman fir, Lazio carpa fir, and Abies coreana, plus Fraser fir.
Right. And this little one I see over here, if we just come over here, is this one.
Yeah.
And I see this one, he's got like the little white, like little white spots on the ends of the leaves. What's that?
That's a Lazio carpa fir.
Right.
Yeah, it's a beautiful...
Now, that's a very new tree, is it not?
Well, it's not new to us.
Because while I'm looking at this one, that looks like little decorations that are already on the tree.
Very elegant tree, beautiful snow white, and the contrast you're right between the white bud and the green, beautiful foliage is, spectacular.
Now, I suppose you would call yourself a Christmas tree farmer. To me, that doesn't run very nicely off the lips.
No, but that's what we are. Yeah, Christmas tree farmer. Yeah, we farm this land here. And we try to make the best use of the soil that we have. We have a lot of respect for the soil. We put organic matter back in the soil. We try to keep the earthworm activity up in the soil. We travel very little on the soil. So, the soil is so important to me. So that's why we have roads structured right throughout the farm so that the soil doesn't get damaged.
But when I think of a farmer, I think of cows and sheep. There's not a cow or a sheep here.
No, no animals. No animals, only the two dogs and the two cats and the two donkeys.
Now, the impression I would have is that you would be fairly slack throughout the year, and then probably come the 1st of December, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. People say to me, what do you do all year?
Yeah, what do you do?
Yeah. I'm very, very busy all year. It's a hands-on job. I have 110 acres here to manage. Some of that's in nursery production, where we're growing little seedlings. We grow our trees from seed. It takes a lot of time. Each individual tree has to be... We do a technique in May when the new buds come out called bud picking. We selectively shape the tree in the winter period. We're trying to produce a nice conical, elegant tree with as little cuts as possible on the tree. We must control the weeds. The trees need nutrition. So depending on our soil analysis each year and our foliage analysis, we put out different minerals. Like, these trees would get calcium lime. They like calcium. So, yeah, we're just trying to give them a nice balanced diet.
And that's what you're doing throughout the year?
So we're doing throughout the year, Terry, yeah.
So come probably 1st of December, would it be right? Or maybe a little bit before it, we take out the saws?
The Ulster men take their trees pretty early. The tree is sold in Ulster sooner than Dublin, and they finish earlier. So typically people in Ulster look for trees about 15th of November.
And will they come down to you looking for trees?
They come down here and they look at the trees. We supply a lot of garden centres in the north, and we supply all the home-based stores on the island of Ireland.
So you're selling more trees now than ever before?
We're selling much, much more. The demand for real trees is unbelievable. Yeah, I can't believe I'm blown away by the amount of people that want real trees. We've a great opportunity, Terry, in this country to grow different range of product, make better use of a field. If you have a field with 10 acres in it, and we can end up like the Dutchman in this country, where 10 acres of ground, you can earn a living from it. Yeah. The younger farmers, what I notice even in Irish Christmas tree growers, farmers tend to be older and bolder like myself, but the younger generation coming along will be willing to change and diversify.
Some Irish environmental groups argue that plantations of large, dense blocks of non-native spruces, pines and firs provide little benefit to wildlife, supporting few native insects, birds or mammals. They also acidify the soil and prevent light from penetrating to the forest floor, meaning that few, if any, other plants get an opportunity to grow up amongst them. But where those trees are planted is even more important. Many commercial spruce plantations have sprung up in what was originally bogland, all too often viewed as waste ground. Ireland's bogs constitute its most important wildlife habitat of all, and are also the most efficient carbon sinks on Earth. Currently, only 3% of our planet's land area is bogland. But that bogland absorbs twice as much carbon dioxide as all the world's forests combined. That said, it is certainly true that growing trees absorb significant quantities of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, helping to combat global warming. Ireland needs to grow more trees. Currently, we have amongst the lowest level of tree cover of any European country.
Now, it is an interesting technology that the conifers have developed. The leaves are long and thin, better to resist the cold and harshness of winter and the strong winds and so forth. The broadleaf trees, well, they decide that the big leaves like that they have are better discarded when things are bad. But the conifer brazens out. It's a great symbol of endurance, of tenacity in the face of adversity. It stands up and fights in a way that other things don't. And they're a great symbol to us at this time of year when the sun is at its lowest. A great sense of triumphing over adversity. And that is what conifers symbolise to us. That's what they do in practice.
What are the environmental and ecological benefits of Christmas trees and of conifers in general? Dr. Richard Collins.
The broadleaf trees, the oaks and the ashes and things like this, they are Johnny-come-latelys in a way. They arrived 125 million years ago, which seems a long time ago, but to a paleontologist it's only the blinking of an eyelid. But anyway, the conifers are around 400 million years ago. They are the pioneers. They are the ones from which the others came. And now, conifers are an interesting lot. They are very important. The largest forest on Earth is the Great Pine Forest, which sweeps all around the Northern Hemisphere, billions of trees. And they're absorbing carbon dioxide and putting out oxygen, most important in a global warming world. Now, the conifers are interesting because they don't go to sleep. The broadleaf trees shed their leaves. They decide to call it a day as well, some of them. And the ones in temperate regions, such as the ones in our part of the world, shed their leaves and go to sleep for a few months and then wake up again, because it doesn't pay them to stay awake in winter. But the conifers decide to brazen it out. They have leaves which act all the year round. They like long, wet periods. Lots of light. Well, in winter not so much, but in summer huge amounts of light, stretching for the full 24 hours in some places, and lots of moisture. In a sense, they are kind of converting moisture into tree, and that is a marvellous achievement, particularly the Sitka spruce, the one that we have in Ireland, brought in from Alaska, a place, Sitka in Alaska. That is almost a converter of water into tree. It is a most remarkable creature and extraordinarily prosperous. They are remarkable in all kinds of ways, and the Christmas tree is kind of a symbol of them in a way. This is a time of year when people step back from life. They take stock. They pause and review things, do you see? It's a time for mindfulness, which is very much in fashion now. The ultimately mindfulness creature is the tree. The tree is sphinx-like. It takes everything in its stride. It doesn't react too strongly, but it survives. They have this mystical kind of timeless quality that kind of suits this time of year. So the tree is very consoling. Trees have been very important culturally. Right back from Pliny the Elder, who talked about the sacred trees of his time, right through to the great oak of which St. Boniface destroyed because it was the Celtic sacred tree and he wanted to convert them to Christianity, right into modern times, the Celts revered trees. And we, at Christmas, we go back to the tree, that sphinx-like character that stands there, timeless in a funny kind of way.
Derek, there at the top of Talbot Street, mm-hmm. you can see a very large Christmas tree. It's Dublin City's flagship Christmas tree. And this is its current location, but a lot of people better remember it as being in the middle of O'Connell Street. That's yes. where it was for many years. I suspect they may have moved it because of the Lewis line.
I imagine
the wires.
So, yes.
Yeah. And so now it's on Talbot Street, which is also a good location for it. But the thing is, I always associate the Christmas tree in Dublin with one particular type of bird. And it's not a bird that normally would have any business being in a coniferous tree. It's not a bird that really likes trees that much at all. And that's the pied wagtail.
Having a real Christmas tree means cutting down and therefore killing a tree. Not just once, but every year. But there are some benefits, as Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland showed me.
The pied wagtail is a bird that is so closely associated with Dublin City that it actually appears on some of the coats of arms of the city itself. It's the Dublin bird in a way. And I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with it. It's often known as the Willy wagtail. Pied obviously means black and white. It's the black and white bird with the long tail that runs frantically like a little clock toy up and down car parks on city streets. Small little bird. Sometimes people think that they're baby magpies. People often contact us to say that. But no, they're not. They're a separate bird, the pied wagtail. And this species is actually found all across Europe and parts of North Africa and through Asia as well, but the form here that's black and white like this is only found in Ireland and in Britain, so it's different from the ones on the continent, which are greyer. Anyway, this is a bird that normally doesn't have much interest in trees except to sleep in them. And I remember on O'Connell Street, going back many years now, back when the plane trees were still there, the London plane trees, that were a good habitat for these birds, I would always say, in the middle of winter, if I was meeting my friends, I'd say, look down the end there, the end of O'Connell Street, down towards Parnell Square. Where the Savoy, exactly. Do you notice anything unusual about that tree at the end? And they would always say, oh yeah, it's the only one that still has its leaves. And I say, well, now, look closer. Those aren't leaves at all. Actually, hundreds of pied wagtails, looking like leaves, cling to the branches. Shoppers walking below there, unaware that there's birds like 3 feet over their heads. And the birds are being very quiet. They're sleeping there in big numbers. And that's where they would always go. When those trees disappeared, when they were replaced, those birds had to move elsewhere. So the roosts aren't as big as they used to be. But the difference was always, though, around Christmas time, when the Christmas tree would go up, the birds would flock to that instead. So all the pied wagtails would sleep in the tree. And it wasn't actually the tree itself they cared about. It was the lights. The lights give off a lot of warmth, and that can be the difference between life and death for the birds like that in the middle of December.
Yes.
So they would huddle together and along the strings of lights. And so still at this time of year, not just in Dublin, but in many towns and cities across Ireland, a great place to find pied wagtails in the winter months around Christmas is to go and look for the Christmas tree and see if they're any sleeping on the lights. They absolutely love it. And the thing is, during the day when people approach them, they run away or they fly away. At night, they just stay completely still and like you can't see me. And people don't. They're just completely oblivious to them. So Christmas tree is a great place to find the pied wagtail in the winter.
So are Christmas trees good for bird life in general, do you think?
Generally,
I shouldn't say Christmas trees, but this species, the spruces, the conifers.
So generally I have to say no, not really. There are environmental benefits, of course, to carbon capture and so forth from these trees. But the trees we use as Christmas trees aren't native to Ireland. We're mainly talking different species of spruce and fir tree. They grow very well in Irish conditions. But the way that they tend to be grown in big plantations, it doesn't support much by way of wildlife. There's also commercial plantations of coniferous trees for other purposes, you know, for timber and for paper and so forth. Things like the Sitka spruce plantations people will be familiar with throughout the Wicklow Mountains, for example, and other parts of the Midlands of Ireland, quite controversial in many cases. And in many cases, unfortunately, those plantations are more or less wildlife deserts. There's nothing really can survive in there because it's a monoculture. They, you know, there's no room, they shade the forest floors, there's no room for undergrowth to grow up because there's no light getting down. The needles acidify the soil. You know, if they're planted particularly in areas of bogland, it's, you know, completely, it can be an ecological disaster. Having said that, obviously when things are done in a sustainable way, there's a place for that. Planting native trees is the best way of all. Unfortunately, our native conifers or evergreens are useless as Christmas trees. We have the Scots pine, which doesn't make a good Christmas tree at all. It's too straggly. You have the yew tree, which it doesn't really look like a Christmas tree in any way, and unfortunately has extremely poisonous berries, so it would be a very dangerous option. So I can see why the spruces are the ones that people use. And the thing, of course, is they're baby spruce trees. They don't ever let to grow fully tall. That lovely sort of pyramid Christmas tree shape that we associate with them, that's a juvenile tree. As the spruce and the other conifers grow higher and older, what happens is those bottom branches fall off, just leaving a canopy. So essentially it's baby trees we have in our house for Christmas.
So my name is Avishtino Quimin, and I'm from a place called Glenamaddy in northeast Galway.
The memories that we associate with Christmas, and with the Christmas tree in particular, can be especially powerful.
But what we used to do was, instead of having an artificial tree or cutting a tree down for Christmas, was we'd take a broadleaf like a birch usually, and put lights on it and some decorations, and then we'd plant it on the farm afterwards. So when you look around the farm now, you can see different trees from different years, and I suppose it was a sustainable thing. Not that we ever thought of it like that.
A Christmas tree bedecked with lights and baubles standing in the living room is a pretty unique and, let's be honest, unusual thing. So it's no surprise that it has become an emotional touchstone for many.
I had a telephone call. I'm based in Luxembourg, but I did a telephone call with my mother last week, and her youngest grandson, Matthew, Granny, he said, "Where's your Christmas tree?" And she had to explain to him that that she wouldn't be putting up a tree this year because Grandad had passed away in July. So that is the tradition in rural Ireland. I'm not sure how widespread the tradition is, but the tradition is that when someone passes away, you don't put up a tree out of respect for the person who has passed. You step back and you reflect, and the absence of the tree symbolises the absence of a loved one.
For some, Christmas is a joyous time, associated with a happy childhood and family bonds. For others, however, Christmas is a difficult, even dreaded occasion, a time filled with poignant memories when the absence of loved ones can feel especially painful. So, as you gather around your own tree this Christmas, think about where it came from, what it represents, and what it means to you. It's much more than just a simple tree.
Oh, Christmas tree. Oh, Christmas tree.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney and was first broadcast in December 2019.
RTE Radio 1.